Martin Luther King, confronting the triple evils of racism, poverty, and militarism, a Building Bridges special. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
Stone monuments and tributes can't adequately commemorate the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Rather, the genuine recognition of the man requires that we resolve to carry on his legacy of resistance to discrimination, the widening wealth divide, and war. I'm Ken Nash. In Memphis, King joined the African-American workers' strike for dignity, I'm a man, for better wages and working conditions, and the right for the workers to collectivize their strength against capital by unionizing.
King helped build movements, bringing to them his perseverance and personal sacrifice, along with his strategic analysis of the state's maintenance of a class system and its racist underpinnings that drew support to it.
We'll speak with activists and the country's leading authority for King, entrusted in 1985 with his vast body of work by Coretta Scott King, the founder and director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute, Claiborne Carson.
Glory, glory, hallelujah, since I laid my burden down,
I feel better, yes. So much better, since I laid my burden down, I feel better.
Is Martin Luther King's messaging ever more prescient now?
When we think about his Vietnam speech that he gave at Riverside Church in New York, exactly a year before he was assassinated, that speech has continuing relevance because what he was doing was warning us that if we didn't learn the lessons of Vietnam, we would be fighting other wars like that into the future. You know, we seem to be a nation, and the speech has even more relevance because now more is at stake. I mean, the wars have become increasingly expensive. He warned that that would divert resources that should be spent here at home to deal with the many pressing problems this nation have, environmental problems, poverty, you know, all the things that he was talking about during his lifetime. His last book was Where Do We Go From Here? I don't think we've answered his question. And he wrote that book in 1967.
Dr. Carson, the interest of King in issues of war and peace, in the poor people's movement, in unions, especially exemplified by the Memphis strike. A lot of people say that came later in his life, but you've maintained very convincingly to me that that has been present throughout his entire career as a social activist, and that he indeed started during the Henry Wallace IV president in 1948. Could you expand on that?
Well, he didn't vote in that election. Coretta was much more involved in the Progressive Party movement than Martin was. She was 2 years older. So she was more of an activist when they met in Boston in 1952. But we do have Martin's papers from 1948. In one of them, he lays out his mission as a minister. I'm going to be concerned about unemployment, slums, economic insecurity. He doesn't mention civil rights. And what is he doing exactly 20 years later? He's leading a poor people's campaign. Rather than seeing him becoming more radical in his last years, I see him returning to the themes that brought him into the ministry in the first place.
When Martin Luther King talked about the intersectionality of fighting for civil rights, economic rights, and against war, he experienced a terrible backlash, but he was unrelenting.
I would back up even further than that and say that to consider him simply as a civil rights leader understates his vision. In some ways, he was an accidental civil rights leader. If he had gone to Mobile, Alabama, rather than Montgomery, who knows where his career would have taken him. He would have still been concerned about what he called the social gospel, But I'm not sure he would have emerged as the most prominent civil rights leader. I think that he had the good fortune to be in the same city as Rosa Parks. Rosa Parks, the black women who organized the bus boycott, made him into a civil rights leader. They organized a boycott and handed him a successful movement to lead and to be the spokesperson for. He was almost drafted into the civil rights movement. But clearly he would have been a significant figure in the black church because he symbolized a theme in the black church that's always been there, of dealing with not just the issue of civil rights, but the broader concerns of the black community. That theme is still there. He symbolized that. What you saw was that the movement for civil rights was a really specific movement about Southern Jim Crow. That movement pretty much ended in 1965. Before and after that, the black community still had a lot of concerns about poverty, discrimination of all sorts, segregation. Those are the continuing concerns. I think I wouldn't understate the importance of what we call the civil rights movement, but I think people should recognize that that particular movement to overcome the Southern Jim Crow system was part of a much larger movement. You know, the NAACP was founded back in 1909, and there are many other black organizations that have been dealing with the wide variety of issues facing the black community. And I think the attack, the assault on the Southern Jim Crow system was something that mobilized many, many thousands of people, including myself. And we should honor that movement and praise it and tell the stories of that movement. But I think we should also realize the limitations of that movement. You know, when he wrote that last book, Where Do We Go From Here, I always focus on where was here at the time. And here was the period after the civil rights struggle against Jim Crow segregation. We're still trying to answer that question. Where do we continue the struggle? And I think because we haven't answered that question very successfully, we still are dealing with war. We're still dealing with poverty. We're still dealing with discriminatory practices, mass incarceration. You know, all of these concerns that have been with us before and after that brief 10-year period when the black community mobilized against legalized segregation in the South.
King's emphasis in the latter part of his life was on the Poor People's Campaign, which also encompassed the Memphis strike. What exactly was his vision for the Poor People's Campaign, and how did he expect to realize that?
His mission was to eliminate poverty. We sometimes forget that there was a war against poverty that was declared by Congress. Now, it turned out to be a minor skirmish against poverty, and we lost the skirmish and gave up the war. But it was national policy of the United States to eliminate poverty after 1965. But there were higher priorities for most people, including Lyndon Johnson. Winning the war in Vietnam turned out to be a higher priority than eliminating poverty. It's almost as if both of those tasks, winning the war in Vietnam and ending poverty, were difficult tasks, but we were willing to spend hundreds of billions of dollars to try to achieve one, and only belatedly recognized we couldn't win that battle, but gave up completely on eliminating poverty. And I think what King realized, and I think we should still realize, is that the capacity to end poverty in the United States is still there. You know, one fraction of the trillions of dollars that we spent on war would end poverty in the United States. And probably better international policies would go a long way to ending poverty, at least extreme poverty, throughout the world. So it is interesting to me that we decide that some problems are intractable. You know, there's always been poverty. But until the 19th century, there had always been slavery. And if people had simply thrown up their hands and said, well, there's always been slavery, and we can't end it, they would have been wrong. And I think the same way we need to look at these problems that we're facing now and recognize that they are solvable problems and that we should turn our attention to those. And that's what King's basic message was, is that we need to reorder our priorities. We need to have a revolution of values. and we still haven't had that.
Martin Luther King talked about tearing down the pillars of poverty, racism, and militarism, which upheld capitalism. Was he advancing a paradigm shift towards socialism?
Part of what I think King brings to discussions of where do we go from here is that he was open to look seriously at the question of capitalism and socialism. It is so unfortunate that our discussion of that issue was constrained by the Cold War. We sometimes forget that a book like Edward Bellamy's Looking Backward, which was published in the 19th century, was a bestseller, and it looked forward to a socialist America. And many people in the world before the rise of the Bolsheviks in Russia made the assumption that if any country was going to lead the way to socialism, it was going to be the United States. But because of the Cold War, because of the rise of particularly the Bolshevik movement in Russia, we kind of came to the point of associating that with another kind of imperialism and dictatorship and all of these things that constrained the discussion of what kind of economic system we needed to have in the United States, and made the assumption that, well, the only way of getting there is confiscate all of private property, rather than understanding that socialism can be a new relationship to opportunity and all the things that we want. The real question is, where does private property end and what kinds of constraints are on it? We live in a world now where a relative few dozen people control trillions of dollars of wealth, more wealth than you could almost buy a country. In some cases, all the valuable resources in many countries have already been bought. There's something wrong with that. We need to deal with it. That discussion is never in the current election. We don't even have a real alternative. It's very difficult to articulate another alternative because of the Cold War, because of the way in which we've constrained our political dialogue in ways that would not have been possible in the United States in the 19th century. That dialogue about what kind of economic system we should have and what fits the needs of the 21st century needs to happen. I don't know why more people are not concerned about why should we have a system where to get a higher education people have to go deep into debt, where the first thing you're asked for when you go to an emergency room is, are you insured? These are kinds of things that I think in a future world I would hope we would be looking back and say, how did people live under that kind of a system? It is in some ways just as savage as slavery. It's in fact, I'm just thinking right now when I mentioned the emergency room, a woman I used to know whose child got his finger caught in a door. She took him to the first hospital, and because he didn't have insurance, they sent him to another hospital. You have a screaming kid whose finger has been damaged, and you can't. Rather than treat the child, you're sending him to another hospital. That kind of a system really has to be changed. And I am encouraged that there is more discussion now about making medical care a right, higher education a right rather than a privilege. But I think we need to go much further in that direction.
Talk about what Dr. King learned from his work up south in the north when he faced down the lynch mobs in the neighborhood of Cicero.
Well, before he came to Chicago, he came to Los Angeles, where I was at the time. I worked with an organization centered and had our headquarters on Central Avenue in South Central Los Angeles. And of course, during the summer of 1965, that was the first big urban explosion of the 60s.
What organization was that, Dr. Carson?
The Nonviolent Action Committee. Mm-hmm. We were among those who had turned to the problems of the urban north, even as many of us were also peripherally involved in the movement in the south. And in fact, a lot of the people who came back from that southern experience launched a number of movements in the urban north that were trying to basically take that energy that was directed against the Southern Jim Crow system and a lot of the tactics and strategies, nonviolent strategies that were used in the South, were then adapted to take on problems like housing discrimination, employment discrimination. You know, my first arrest, I actually didn't get arrested the first time, but it was the first time I did a sit-in, was not in the South, but at a grocery market in South Central Los Angeles, where even though the grocery market was in the black community, no black people were hired as clerks there.
What year are we talking about?
We're talking about 65. Mm-hmm. You know, from about 63 on, the movement increasingly came north, and there were mass marches against segregated schools in Chicago and New York. There were, you know, as I said, protests in San Francisco against housing and employment discrimination. The Northern Movement has not received nearly the attention that the Southern Movement, because it was actually Southern segregation was an easier target, because the South was an outlier for the nation. You know, so it was antiquated system that in some ways was easier to attack, because potentially you could mobilize the federal government on your side. With respect to the conditions in the urban north, that was a much larger job, because that was often the place where Martin Luther King would go and raise money to deal with the problems in the South. But in the urban north, you had an entrenched system of segregation itself. But it was much harder to fight against that, because many of the same people who would favor desegregation in the South were sending their kids to segregated schools in the North. Today, there are at least as many black kids going to predominantly black schools as there were at the time of the Brown decision. You know, anyone who opens their eyes can see that segregation is still there. It's just not legally mandated as it was in the South. So those problems were much more difficult, and what King found out is that the resistance was, if anything, more intense, because at least in the South, it was directed against the public accommodations and things like that. It wasn't about neighborhood segregation. It wasn't about, you know, the kind of segregation that still exists. You know, just how many white Americans would want their child to go to a predominantly black school today? Anytime that happens, there's a pretty fierce reaction against it. How many white Americans feel comfortable if their neighborhood becomes increasingly black? You know, we have to face these issues. By ignoring these issues, they fester. You know, one of the metaphors that he talked about in his last book was the world house, and how we'd inherited this house, you know, the earth, its diverse population, and we have to learn how are we going to live together with people who are unlike ourselves. And that learning process is not an easy one. You know, it requires empathy. It requires the ability to see things through the eyes of someone else. It requires us to at least try to learn a language other than English, to try to understand why there are different religions in the world and what they represent. Try to understand Iran from the point of view of the Iranians and their history. Those kinds of things are vital. What King understood is that that had to be confronted, and he found in Chicago that he had never been faced with a white mob in the South. There might be the Klan and occasional bombings and killings, and you know that was terrible. But when there were protests in Birmingham, there wasn't a mob of white people confronting it. Most Americans kind of underestimated the significance of the Southern struggle of being almost a warning sign for problems that were embedded in the entire nation. And there was too much of an emphasis of change elsewhere rather than recognizing that many of the problems were right next door and right in your own community.
How did the inequality rooted in the system of capitalism and the particular harsh and enduring deprivation of people of African ancestry inform the philosophy and work of Dr. King?
He had only started on that journey. He died at 39 years old. So Martin Luther King's life was cut off before we even know where he would have taken it in the 1970s, 1980s. That journey would have taken him into areas where he was extremely unpopular, and he would not have had this success. His Vietnam speech, he says, if we don't face the problem of why we are in Vietnam, and he names Venezuela, Mozambique, Cambodia. The speech really suggested where the future was heading. You have a leader who would have been protesting against that the whole way. In some respects, because he had that 10-year period of being a civil rights leader, that's enough to make him a national holiday, because we can see that that movement was successful. We don't have legalized public segregation at public places anymore. But the other aspects of his agenda that we're still facing, we haven't answered his question, where do we go from here? That was what he was asking in 1967. And look at the debates. How many times in the political debates of this year has the issue of poverty been raised? It's still a largely ignored issue. How many times have we seen a debate focused on the way our society is still largely segregated? Large areas of America, residential. One of the things that King talked about is the most segregated hour, 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. We still live in a largely segregated world, and that hasn't changed. And having Martin Luther King pester us about it would have made him, crossed him off the list of potential people to be honored with a national holiday. One thing I should mention is that, we just released a new recording of King's Riverside speech. And you might go to our website it was found at Riverside Church, and it's a much better recording of the speech. It's on our website, and I think it's on the Riverside Church website right now. But in any case, I'll probably be in New York because they are having a commemoration of the speech anniversary.
Oh, fantastic!
It was always there. It's really odd because when you listen to the existing recordings, it was obvious that their microphone was not the microphone that King was using. So you get a lot of ambient noise and all the recording that was released as a record. But the microphone right in front of King was recording him also. But that recording was never released. And so it just went into their archive, and just a few months ago was discovered.
Wow.
And when people listened to it, it became obvious that that was the superior recording. You could close your eyes and believe that Martin Luther King was right there in the church.
Wow.
And that's exactly what we're going to do. You will be hearing on the radio waves the magnificent Riverside speech that was unearthed by Riverside Church and given to Claiborne Carson.
A time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us in relation to Vietnam. But we must speak. Perhaps a new spirit is rising among us, for we are deeply in need of a new way beyond the darkness that seems so close around us. Over the past 2 years, as I have moved to break the betrayal of my own silences and to speak from the burnings of my own heart, as I have called for radical departures from the destruction of Vietnam. Many persons have questioned me about the wisdom of my path. At the heart of their concerns, this query has often loomed large and loud. Why are you speaking about the war, Dr. King? Why are you joining the voices of dissent? Peace and civil rights don't mix, they say. Aren't you hurting the cause of your people, they ask. For such questions mean that the inquirers have not really known me. Indeed, their questions suggest that they do not know the world in which they live. I deem it of signal importance to try to state clearly. A few years ago, there was a shining moment. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. Then came the build-up in Vietnam, and I watched this program broken and eviscerated, as if it was some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonic destructive suction tube. The Vietnamese people proclaimed their own independence in 1945 after a combined French and Japanese occupation. They were led by Ho Chi Minh. Even though they quoted the American Declaration of Independence in their own document of freedom, we refused to recognize them. Instead, we decided to support France in its reconquest of a former colony. Our government felt then that the Vietnamese people were not ready for independence.
So much to learn, so much to think about, and I hope that in the weeks to come that we have an opportunity to play more of Dr. Martin Luther King, but it's been great being with you and bringing you this tribute.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash.